Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Routes, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between rural and urban America on a Red Shirt Friday. I don't know, Todd McFarland, what, like this sixth Friday in a row, you've taken the time to join us to bring us up to speed on a trial?
Hey, you know what? I went back and double-checked the math, Trent. It's actually number seven.
Wow.
Today.
What are you going to do next Friday?
Good question. I've been saying, though, we need to get together and have a little celebratory party, so...
So for those that might not be up to speed, we have been following the federal trial, which I have said from day one is rural America on trial. And you said that we need to have a celebration because it appears the Oregon trial is over. Is that true?
Yes, the Oregon standoff trial came to a conclusion yesterday. There was a lot of drama this week, Trent. For those who haven't followed it, they started deliberations last week. This week, the drama basically centered around or focused on some notes, jury questions that were passed to Judge Brown, indicating that the jury was in deadlock and that one of the jurors, right at the outset of the deliberations, had stated that he was very biased. Well, something should have been done about that right then, but as it turned out, that juror had slipped through what we call voir dire or voir dire questioning. He had underreported his background, his experience. Turns out the guy was a former BLM employee and a current law enforcement officer with the Department of Corrections. It turns out, after what happened yesterday, that it looks like the rest of the jury was unanimous in its consensus about what it wanted to do. And this obviously, and he came in and stated that he was very biased, was trying to hold out. What would have happened would have been that he would have created a hung jury. But based on that information coming out, ultimately after she was pushed really hard and with much resistance, Judge Brown did dismiss juror number 11, an alternate juror was randomly selected, given time to get to Portland. They restarted the deliberations from scratch yesterday and only took a few hours to reach a unanimous not guilty verdict on all counts except one. The one count involved the taking down of FBI surveillance cameras, and the jury was not able to reach a consensus on that one count. There was a hung jury on that count. All other counts, however, they came back unanimous, not guilty verdicts for each and every defendant. Trent, it was an earthquake.
Mm-hmm. What I didn't even understand myself until the question was posed from the jury to the judge about the same time as juror number 11 came out of the closet, they had to find all either guilty or not guilty because of the way they were tried?
No. They had the opportunity to go through, and they had a verdict form for each and every defendant and each and every charge. Mm-hmm. So in, say, Ammon Bundy's case, they would have had a separate form for him where they would check, basically, guilty of conspiracy to impede or interfere with government officers and guilty of the firearms charge. Well, but we talked about this before. The minute they found that these defendants were not guilty of the conspiracy charge, even if there was evidence that any of them had possessed a firearm, that charge immediately went away because the firearms charge, and so many people have misunderstood this. They thought, well, they had a firearm in a federal facility, and so that's automatic. No, that's not necessarily automatic, and that's not necessarily the case. It wasn't the case in this instance. The only way they could have been found guilty on the firearms charges is if the government had been able to prove that they possessed firearms while in commission of another crime. So if they were not found guilty of conspiracy, there was no other crime, and so the firearms charge automatically went away at that point, Trent. Mm.
There were several, and you probably have the number, that actually pled early to charges that are similar to the ones these guys were found not guilty of. What do you reckon they're thinking right now?
Oh, man. You know, I'm very closely associated with one of those. We never really talk about that story, Trent, on the radio. But when I was there and you were there on the 8th and 9th of January, and at that time I met up there. I call him a kid because he's 20 or so years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. A young man by the name of Wes Kerr, K-J-A-R, who was actually from my hometown. And so our paths crossed, and he ultimately decided, and there were a variety of reasons why, but that he decided he was ready to take a break, leave. He ended up leaving with me and the party I was with that day because he needed to ride out, and brought him back to Utah. And he had only been there for 4 or 5 days, left. He got there after the fact, was there for 4 or 5 days, much like you and I were, except obviously they were taking the position that he had an entirely different role in the whole thing.
Right.
But they ended up charging him. He ended up spending at least a month in jail, both here in Utah, in Pahrump, Nevada, and then in Oregon before we were finally able to get him released on pretrial release. But based on, you know, the facts and circumstances, they did come to him and say, we're going to cut you a really sweet deal. No further incarceration. We understand that you really didn't have much of a role, but you actually came back to Utah and took extraordinary steps to try to resolve the situation, did all of that kind of stuff. So we're going to cut you a really sweet deal, but we're still going to require, and this is non-negotiable, that you plead guilty to a felony. Plead guilty to a felony, Trent. He was under a lot of pressure. I went with him to Portland back in June when he entered that plea deal, and some things happened en route, and I advised him against it. I said, there's new information here. You really need to tell them that you need more time to think about this. Your court-appointed attorney in Oregon needs to get to the bottom of this so that you... So, number one, he can give you informed advice instead of uninformed advice, and so that you can make an informed decision. Well, the government was putting so much pressure on him to either take or leave that plea that day, or it was off the table, and he was concerned because he'd spent a year, and he was, or not a year, a month,
right.
And he was concerned that he'd go back, that he ultimately did go ahead and make the plea. It's not completely over yet because he hasn't been sentenced, but he's probably going to have to turn around now and make a motion to withdraw his guilty plea, and they'll probably fight it and resist it, and it'll be a whole bunch of work, when in reality, they ought to turn around and dismiss all of the charges against everybody else based on the outcome of this trial. But do you think they'll do that, Trent? What's
no.
your wager?
I think I'd wager my ranch on that one.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Matt Schindler and we talked about, there's all kinds of attorneys that have been involved in this case, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Some of them, and I spent time up there and I paid close attention to the case, some of them just seemed like potted plants. They just sat there and basically didn't do much, you know. There were including of the court-appointed it.
Yeah, a little technical difficulty there. I lost Todd. We will take a break and come back with more Rural Route as we continue to talk about the verdict that has been handed down this week in Oregon on the 7 defendants for occupation of Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. More Rural Route with Todd McFarland happening after this.
Speaking of the Europeans, I want to tell you about our MPS Agra sow feeding system. It's an electronic sow feeding system. There continues to be a lot of discussion about the best way to house sows. Well, the one thing that in the first 2 months that I absolutely love about this system is the sow goes in the feeding station. The feed is electronically dropped from a Windows-based computer software program. And our sows are averaging about 40 minutes eating. What does that mean? It means that they are relaxed. They are relieved of stress. They're taking their time and they're utilizing the food that they're getting. It's not a drive-by. It's not a drive-through meal anymore. That's the biggest difference. When you floor feed and you feed sows in groups, it's like fast food. They got to grab a bite and run. These sows, they're sitting in a fine dining establishment with no stress. It's about minimizing the stress. Check out the Chieftain. That's the system I have. MPSAgra.co.uk. MPS Agra. It's simply the way to feed sows.
Welcome back to Rural Route. I'm Trent Luce, and the automatic screening process taking place. Technical difficulties, just not having my act together, and there are seven words you can't use on the air, Todd McFarland.
And that was one of them?
That's one of them.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd have to go beep.
So, okay, well, you know, I'm usually really, really safe, you know, but even with my Mormon LDS upbringing, there were a few that we considered not to be particularly. Yeah, they're the kind of words you talk about when you're out working cows and
absolutely.
That kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah. So, and then my other technical issue was that I had a computer die, and I heard you say that some of the attorneys were like potted plants. Is that what you really said?
I really didn't say that, Trent.
Those words are acceptable on the air, particularly when you're talking about an attorney, by the way.
Yeah, you know, that phrase has stuck in my mind for now over 30 years. I still remember. This is fixed in my mind. I remember we talked a couple weeks ago about some of my backstory and being a high school jock and playing college football and all that. Well, I did finally go to law school, and I was actually on the waiting list. I had lofty aspirations at one point in time to go to an Ivy League school, and I was actually on the waiting list at Cornell Law School. So I packed up my wife, and this is clear back in 1987, and we drove through Nebraska. I remember bumping across Nebraska because our car, our little Honda Accord, was so weighted down that boom, boom, boom. I mean, it was crazy, Trent.
Right.
But that whole way from Utah to upstate New York, if people remember, in 1987, it was the Iran-Contra hearings, congressional hearings, and I remember especially when Marine Colonel Oliver North was testifying, and I was, you know, here I am. I'm an aspiring law student, lawyer, all that stuff. I'm just fascinated by this stuff, listening to it on the radio when we'd stop at night. I'd be watching it. My wife, she was just sick and tired of it. But anyway, I remember Oliver North's attorney, and someone reminded me of what his name was the other day when I mentioned this. Now it slipped my mind.
Yeah, but I don't remember either.
Yeah, Oliver North, he's sitting there testifying, and his attorney didn't have a whole lot to say, and nothing was going on. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, his attorney jumps up and makes an objection, and everybody acts so surprised. And he said, well, I'm not a potted plant here, you know, so ever since then, it's stuck in my mind. But I'll be honest, and I've written about this, and I've probably even put it in some of my videos, some of the attorneys involved in the case did remind me of potted plants. But others definitely did not. And I don't know if you heard the whole story, Trent, that attorney Marcus Mumford, he was actually taken down in court yesterday after the verdict was read, tackled by multiple U.S. marshals, tased for arguing that Ammon Bundy should be released from incarceration based on the verdict.
Mm-hmm. I actually did watch the YouTube presentation with Marcus Mumford explaining exactly what happened, and it was like, are you kidding me? That really happened in a courtroom?
Can you believe that?
No. Of course, there's a series of you saying something, and I say, I can't believe that, for the last 7 weeks, Todd.
Right.
I mean, he said, what he said was, I was just asking for the papers. And they didn't generate any papers. They tackled me. Is this playground football or what?
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. In fact, you know, it brings up a relevant point because I put up a new post this morning on Range Fire. It's called The Biggest Initial Takeaways from the Oregon Standoff Trial. And number one was that LaVoy Finicum's death was completely unjustified. And that when they made that stop, and I know a lot of people have tried to say all kinds of stuff, and the federal government says, well, we had probable cause. Well, guess what the outcome of this trial demonstrates?
Mm-hmm.
They had no probable cause, but other people have tried to claim, well, they had arrest warrants. It goes back to what Attorney Mumford was saying. Show me the paperwork. Show me the documentation. And that's exactly what should have happened way back when. There were no arrest warrants. There were no arrest warrants. It's something we have to do in this country. We have to say, show me the paperwork. Because when it doesn't exist, then, and that's often the case. So, yeah, it's good I wasn't there. I'd have been asking exactly the same question that he was. Show me the paperwork. Show me what justification you have to continue to hold him. Now, of course, they're going to claim that there's a hold in Nevada. But we see that, unfortunately, with government officials all the time, Trent. They just make stuff up and they say it. And there is, you know, then they have to make up. They have to try to get the paperwork to catch up with what they're saying. But at that moment in time, Ammon Bundy, even though it might have only been for a little while, but he could have, you know, maybe hugged his wife or something like
right.
that, he should have been able to be a free man for at least a few minutes.
And that did not happen. They whisked him off to Nevada already?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if that's all happened yet, but they did not release him from custody, and I'm sure that's all in the world. I mean, This has come as such a shock and a surprise to so many people, including all the government players. And it comes back to something I talked about before. I attended what we call a continuing legal education seminar a few years ago, and the keynote speaker at that, and the title of his speech and what he had to say has stuck in my mind ever since. And the title of it was The Crisis of Overconfidence in the Legal Profession.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, that's what we've been dealing with this entire trial. It's been the overconfidence of the federal government, of Judge Brown, of the media, the mainstream media. I mean, you and I have been talking about this all the way along, and some people really started to pick up on that this week. What's the mainstream media even thinking? I mean, I've been saying the whole time the government's been putting on a very weak, marginal case. But the mainstream media, they had just acted like this was just a total shock, total surprise. Was it a big surprise to you when it finally happened?
I have to admit that it was a surprise. I did not.
Well, it was a surprise.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I honestly thought that there would probably be a hung jury.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought that there would probably be a hung jury in the case. I didn't think that they'd be able to reach a consensus, so I'll have to admit, even I was surprised to see a unanimous not guilty verdict for every defendant on every charge except one. I don't know anyone who wasn't surprised by that degree of message being sent about this whole thing. But anyway, interesting.
I have not been able to go look at some of the what you call Bundy haters to see how they've responded. I'm sure they have plenty to say about that.
You know, there is some stuff, but it's gone pretty quiet, actually, except for some of the really, really hard diehards. And I was in kind of a running battle yesterday on social media with Karan Suckling with the Center for Biological Diversity, who was claiming that the so-called Bundy militia had engaged in coercion and coercive acts with respect to Native Americans, and I was kind of trying to hold his feet to the fire on those statements. But a lot of folks, I think, in fact, there was one that I've been interacting with because I was kind of goading them a little bit. I said, based on stuff that was happening, I said, you know, the Bundy bashers, now I call them the Bundy phobes, the Bundy haters. Of course, they call them poots. You know that, right,
John? Yeah, right. I think we can say that on the air.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I actually, I kind of interacted with them a little bit about that because I was kind of scratching my head trying to figure out what that was all about, and they joking around about the poots and everything. I actually put up some stuff showing that the historical definition of poot, Trent, you know what it is?
No.
It's actually, it comes from Great Britain. It's actually a fancy person's fart.
Part?
Fart. In other words, a flatulatory experience when you pass gas, right? So if you were a fancy person...
I don't know if we can say that on the air either.
Oh, man, is that one of the...
I don't know. Let me go check the dictionary.
Boy,
we'll be back.
We're really pushing the limits this morning.
Roll out after this.
And that's correct. You know, I know you are one of Superior Livestock. Yes. Is a sponsor of the program, and just because you work for Superior sponsorship, we sold our calves to Superior this year, and that's what we'll continue to do next year. Just basically connecting the dots and doing a good job for the consumer and getting a premium price for what we do every day.
And that's what you do with the pork too. I mean, you connect the consumer to a Duroc, sorry, they really don't care. But the fact that you go to the effort to make sure that there's a high quality end product here resonates with them.
Welcome back to Rural Route. I'm Trent Luce alongside on a red shirt Friday for the seventh consecutive week, Todd McFarland, who will have to find something to talk about next week on Friday, I'm sure. I'm now out of North Dakota. I'm en route home today. But I wanted to spend a little time comparing the two situations because I started my year in Harney County, Oregon. I saw up close and personal with all of my new friends like Todd that media presents a selective portrayal of the truth. They find a tidbit of truth. They don't lie. But they make things appear like they want them to be. I saw that for week after week. I would see something on CNN or even Fox News, and I was like, that's not what was there happened. I was there. Same exact thing is happening from the pipeline protest in North Dakota. The very interesting thing about it is the dynamics are totally different, Todd. And I think it ties into the path you were going down, because I did get the opportunity yesterday to sit down with who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, the sheriff of Morton County, North Dakota, Kyle Kirkmeyer. He has zero federal involvement in this situation. In fact, he's asked for some assistance, and they refused to help him. And you'll remember what Burns was like, because it was a federal presence and intimidation like I could not even have imagined. And this is completely being run by the county sheriffs of the state of North Dakota.
I've been giving all of that a lot of thought lately, Trent, you know. And so I really think this is interesting stuff to talk about. Someone told me yesterday that they estimated that there were at least 500 federal, whatever you want to call them, operatives, agents, FBI, in Burns, in Harney County, in January 2016. And you had everything from plainclothes guys to guys who were fully decked out to confidential informants to agents provocateur. And I'd be willing to bet dollars to donuts on that in North Dakota, even though Sheriff Kirkmeyer can't get any help from the federal government. I'll bet dollars to donuts that there are federal agents provocateur working that whole situation. What's your bet?
No, I'm not betting you on that because I know that's the case. but they're in a completely different role than they were.
Absolutely.
In Barnes. They're on
right.
the other side.
Right.
And to put this into perspective for folks, you said at one point in time, the maximum number of people that occupied Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, the maximum was 50. And we now know that 15 of those were feds, informants, undercover, whatever the case may be. So, do you
well,
think
yeah, and that's 50, that's people coming and going, being there, I mean, yeah.
Right, right. They claim there was 8,000 people at this protest at one point in time. Yesterday,
right.
I saw not anything close to 8,000. I saw
right.
maybe 1,000 people.
Right.
Okay, so the feds have got what we know to be a very skeleton crew for a protest number between 3,000 and 8,000. You had between 25 and 50 in Burns, and they had 500 people involved. How do those two things parallel one another?
Yeah, one of the things that I've given a lot of thought, because one thing I'm going to say right out of the chutes, Trent, and a lot of people, you know, don't believe in... Personally, I have no problem with protesting. I don't care what the situation is. If you're not happy with it, if you want to make your voice heard, I tip my hat to those people who get off the couch and go protest. Now, you know, that can be misguided, you know. There's no question about that. And I'm interested to hear the rest of the story that you're talking about, because yesterday we talked and you said there's a whole lot more backstory to this. I want to hear some of that. But I got thinking, what are the differences between North Dakota and Burns, too? Is that in Burns at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, the protest was against government. The protest mm-hmm. was against the federal government on behalf of the Hammonds and other abuses and federal overreach. But the protest was against basically federal overreach in a nutshell. In North Dakota, the protest is basically against private enterprise. I mean, from my perspective, right out of the chutes, you're dealing with an apples and oranges comparison, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I was there gathering information, and I could not broadcast live like I thought I would from the site where I saw 20 people arrested while I was there.
Right.
They report that 141 were arrested yesterday. There were shots fired before the day ended after we left. They were arresting a young lady, apparently, and she shot 3 times at deputies.
Wow.
Yep. And to the testament.
But to their credit, she's still alive, I guess, right?
They didn't even draw their weapons. I saw, Todd, these rioters throwing chunks of wood at a line of deputy sheriffs who were trying to get them off of the state highway. And the biggest one difference, and I agree with you completely, the First Amendment is in my shirt pocket, and I believe in it, the right to assemble, the right to freedom of speech. But they put...
Yeah, if there's one thing you and I do completely
right.
believe in and agree in, it's the First Amendment. That's the platform we operate on, right?
It's exactly right. But with their First Amendment, they're squatting on deeded property. They're squatting on somebody else's land. It's not even government land. They're on deeded property. They put took tree timbers, I mean huge tree timbers, and took a Montana plated pickup. I say Montana plated because everybody tries to say this is the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota taking a stand. They didn't even use a Res Runner pickup. They had a Montana plated pickup and put it up on those timbers and blocked a state highway. And so every time you hear media giving an account of what happened, they talk about how the police are trying to break up the peaceful prayer. It's not peaceful prayer. They got a state highway blocked, and they're squatting on private property. There's a difference.
And I think it's really important that we do talk about, again, because I want to emphasize, I'm a believer in protesting. I'm a believer in all the rights covered under the First Amendment. I definitely am. Having said that, I want to, yeah, let's participate in this probing of the differences, the comparison, the contrast. You were telling me something yesterday about how at least you'd gotten some kind of line on that. Originally, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe wanted the pipeline to cross the reservation, and they wanted to extract a large amount of money in exchange for the easement. And then, once that didn't work out quite the way they wanted it to, and the company decided to go a different route instead of across the reservation, then they started protesting. What did you find out, if anything, about that, Trent?
Nothing. I delved into that, and there's tons of speculation and rumor. The Energy Transfer Company itself did make a statement and say, no, we never planned on going across reservation land. So that might just be hearsay. I can't put any credibility to it now. But
I think it's important that we acknowledge that sort of thing, because if there's one thing you and I don't want to do, it's to take something like that and spout it out there as if that's the case. But, you know, we can speculate, we can talk about that kind of stuff, as long as we're acknowledging and telling it exactly what it is. This, you know, we're not claiming this is fact or this is truth. This is some of the scuttlebutt that's out there. We've tried to dig deep into it. We haven't been able to corroborate or verify it, and so we're not going to pretend that we can, right?
That's exactly right. What we do know is that there is a process in which the tribe had equal opportunity to voice their concern through public hearings and before the construction of this pipeline got to this point, to talk about these sacred tribal grounds, because all of a sudden now they're talking about, they're digging through sacred tribal grounds.
Well, okay, there's ample time to have
that discussion earlier in the system. As it's structured, nobody said a word. Nobody protested at all.
So one of the things that came out, it was immediate. As soon as the verdict came down, then I immediately started seeing on social media the fact and comparing Oregon to North Dakota, and that they were saying that the reason that these verdicts came down the way they did was based on white privilege and saying, anyway. So that's one thing I want to really kind of clarify too, Trent. I mean, you've talked about your experience and background working with the Native Americans in North Dakota, and I've talked about, and some people question, but I have close ties to Native American interests here in Utah. There's a small reservation real close to where I live. I'm on the Kanosh Band of Paiute Indians Enterprise Board. I work with them regularly. I've stood up for them in a number of ways. So I'm a big advocate of Native American interests. But there are people out there that are trying to say that, you know, if this had been Native American interests in Oregon or vice versa, that it would be a completely different outcome. What's your thoughts on that, Trent? I mean, I'm really troubled by that rhetoric.
Yeah, well, you're going to be even more troubled because I'm going to tell you, we'll talk about it after the break. Rural Route, Todd McFarland, we've got one more segment left. We've talked about the trial and the verdict that we're happy with in Oregon. We're comparing it to what's happening today in North Dakota. More Rural Route after this.
The time is now, my friends, to say thank you to those individuals, the troops, that continue to risk their lives to protect our freedom. There's a group of cattlemen from the Great Plains of America that found a way to say thank you. 250,000 individuals in the past 7 years have been given a handshake and supplied with a full meal deal, including a 1-pound ribeye. The All-American Beef Battalion on the best crusade of our life. Make your contribution and help us, please, at steaksfortroops.com.
And let's talk about marketing cattle the superior way. More details about finding your rep and what the upcoming sales might be like. I just want to focus right now on the November 17th Superior Select Female Sale. Cattle prices are not what they were. There's no doubt about that. Possibly it's a time for you to add some select genetics. Details online, www.superiorlivestock.com.
Welcome back to Rural Routes. I'm Trent Lewis alongside Todd McFarland. Joining us, he's in Utah. I'm en route home from the Dakota Access Pipeline riots. They are riots. There is no doubt in my mind it is perceived differently, and the federal government handles it differently because this is close to reservation land, and it is American Indians involved. It changes the dynamics of everything. You know, the one thing, there's a lot of things that I saw yesterday that were just, I was like, wow. I saw many women pulling in their SUVs, brand new, I mean, new, you know, new modern SUVs, with California license plates and an Indian wig and braids.
Okay, I was going to ask you, how many of these folks are actually Native Americans versus other activists? So you're headed there, Trent.
Exactly.
Keep going.
They're blondes, they're brunettes, but you can tell they have purchased a black wig that's got braids to make them look like Sacagawea, and they go stand up there at the front of the line and taunt the police officers who are simply trying to get these folks off of deeded property and off of a state highway. But what floors me about it is you can tell they went and bought, like it's a Halloween costume, they went and bought wigs to make it look like they're Indians. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. Now, you ask me how many. I don't know. I'm going to say, obviously, the core right through the middle of it. They're predominantly female, by the way, and they definitely have American Indian blood, and there are some from Standing Rock. There's no doubt about that. But I went to the Standing Rock main community of Fort Yates, and I asked people, "Are you going to the protest?" "No, I don't want to be up there." I think 2/3 of the people on that reservation don't want any part of it. And that's what I'm going to do next week, is I'm going to find the people who say, this is ridiculous. We don't want any part of this. You with me?
Yeah, I was multitasking for just a second there, Trent.
You know that women say we can't do that.
Right. Well, and I'm not very good at it. They're better at it than I am.
Yeah.
But back to women, you know, I think a point you're making is true, that a lot of times they are more passionate about some of this stuff, and so they're but I think your point there too was, you talked earlier about all the SUVs, the plates and everything from California, the wigs, and of course they're the ones that are doing that. But even of the Native Americans, if I understood correctly, you're saying most of them that are there protesting are Native American women. Did I understand that correctly, Trent?
I said the majority of them are women. I'm not saying
right.
There are not guys there. There are.
Oh, of course.
But
right.
It seemed to me that there were more women, more moved, and right in the middle of, I mean, what they did, in the news today is reporting that the police puts pepper spray on these prayerful protesters. They weren't.
Right.
They did use pepper spray. I saw people who had to go get their eyes rinsed out with pepper spray, but they were in the back of this pickup and wouldn't get out. That's blocking, that they put in as a blockade across the state highway. And I got a video that I've now tagged you in on Twitter that shows how patient these law enforcement officials are. They're telling them, we don't care if you're back at your camp. Go back to your camp. You cannot be on the state highway. And they're just inch by inch moving them. I think they started at 9:30 yesterday morning, and it took them until dusk to move, to clear that highway, and it's
right.
about 1 mile, about 1 mile.
Right. I watched the images, and they went, I mean, so they, it, that is a very daunting, intimidating force with the AMRAPs and the Bearcats and the whole line of people and everything, but they're just kind of moving things. So let's compare that, for example, and I think, again, just to put everything in context, you know, we're big believers in the First Amendment, and one of the things that happened in Bunkerville, for example, was that when that whole standoff actually occurred under the wash, the freeway got shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I-15 got shut down, and it was backed up for miles. And I think we all recognize that even when there is some kind of legitimate, valid protest for whatever reason, you can't just shut down roads
right.
and freeways and highways. I mean, you can't shut them down indefinitely. Maybe it happens temporarily. Maybe it makes a point. But you just can't shut something like that down indefinitely and not have the status change. I mean, at a certain point in time, freeways got to be opened back up. People need to be able to continue to move. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't still be able to continue to protest. Again, like you say, if you're on somebody's private property, and I'm a believer in protesting, I'm a believer in the First Amendment, but if everybody and their dog wants to set up camp on my ranch, on my property, and just take it over, that I think that's a different story than property that is what we call public property. Public property, Trent, I've written about and I've talked about the whole Rainbow family and what they do, and they go to public property, the BLM or the Forest Service, every summer, and they take a position. This is public property. It belongs to us as a people. We're going to set up camp. We're going to do things. And you know what? If people do that on public property, I think that's a legitimate use of public property. But I think when we talk about private property rights, included in private property rights, are the right to exclude people from our private property. That's what makes it private. So I think that's part of the apples and oranges distinctions that need to be made and we need to be talking about in the overall context of this discussion, don't you?
I do, and there's something else coming front and center that you and I have talked about at great lengths, particularly with our symposium that we had in Layton, Utah. And what I've been attempting to do, as my partner Hank Vogler has for the last 14 years on this program, is show how the federal lands rancher has a right to the grass and owns the grass, just like I own my my piece of property at my place. And I got to give him credit. It was Hank Vogler who said, hey, look, if they can renege on a right that was granted to us, dating back to before 1900, what's to say they're not going to renege on the 1862 Homestead Act and say, oh, well, by the way, we're no longer going to let you own that piece of property. I talked to people yesterday that were from New Mexico and California that were not on the front lines, but they were back at, we'll call it headquarters, orchestrating and strategizing on how to get more people to the site so that they could increase the media presence so that their financiers could see they're getting the job done. And when I talk to these two guys and who they really represent, they represent a global entity that ultimately believes people should not own land. And his words were co-governance. We should have co-governance. I said, what does co-governance mean? Well, nobody should be able to say that this is my property. It should be for the common good of all people. And when you hear the chairman of the Standing Rock Tribe talking about the 1851 treaty that was broken, that ultimately what they're saying is that we want to predate that Homestead Act so that we can get that land back away from the rightful deeded owners. So if you boil it all down, Todd, what's happening here is really at the root, no different than what you've been dealing with in the West, an erosion of private property rights and the ability to utilize your land as you see fit. That's really what's at the core.
You're absolutely right. That is the underlying issue that I see across the board in this country, and it's one of the biggest points in this conflict between rural and urban America. Why is it that that divide creates and kind of feeds that issue, Trent?
Because we're now to the point where the majority of Americans don't have anything, and so they don't truly respect and understand property rights. Everything should be theirs for the taking because they've never had anything. They live in a little apartment. One of the other, I want to get this in because I think it shows the hypocrisy. I have finally had to ask this guy, who funds you? Where do you get your funding? Because it was all about anti-corporate corporations through oil or destroying the environment or destroying the world or destroying human lives. It's anti-corporate, anti-corporate. I said, so if it wasn't oil, you wouldn't care? Yeah, it's all about the oil because it generates too much wealth and greed. I said, well, who funds you? And he walked me through three entities that fund his global organization that are all people who have created a monopoly in the business that they're in. For example, one guy, he says, is responsible for 90% of the flour sold in the world. So it's okay if the corporation is funding me, but the corporations that don't fund me are bad. That hypocrisy is just
unbelievable. That seems to be the double standard. Trent, I don't know if you're watching your sound quality meter, but at least on my end, and I hate to say this, but it sounds like you've got some sound quality issues. Check that out.
I'm actually good on this end. It could be my cell signal to you.
Yeah.
But we have one minute. I need you to wrap it up in 1 minute.
Okay, so how do you want things wrapped up? The Oregon standoff trial came to an end. Not guilty verdicts for all defendants. Comparing Oregon to North Dakota, it's an apples and oranges comparison that leaves us scratching our heads. But the bottom line is there's a serious erosion of private property rights and interests in America. What else should we say for the wrap-up?
I think you nailed it. We've successfully journeyed down the road connecting rural and urban America. My thanks, Todd McFarland. I'm Trent Luce, both of us reminding you that all roads do lead to a rural route.
And let's finish up today talking about the world of marketing cattle the superior way. I'm now on the website looking at the different value-added programs that you might be a part of. The next video sale is going to be on next Friday. Next Friday, November the 4th, and then 2 weeks after that, there'll be more information. So find your rep, look at the upcoming schedule. You can even get a weather map. Weather maps are everywhere, including SuperiorLivestock.com. A little strength in that cattle market this week. Check out the City Sidewalk, busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style, the Superior Way, with your cap for your gift. www.SuperiorLivestock.com.